You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Welcome to Dragon Root Radio, feminist-inspired radio brought to you by CKUT and the 2110 Center for Gender Advocacy. The Dragon Root has two genders and symbolizes the diversity of every body and every mind on the gender spectrum. Tune in every Tuesday morning from 8:39 on 90.3 FM or ckut.ca/listen. You can also pick up and choose from our archives at center2110.org. We bring you reports from the Blueprint Radio Project on gendered violence, live tunes from feminists, queer, trans, and gender-aware musical guests, and interviews about a wide array of social justice issues examined through a gender-perceptive lens. And today on Dragon Root, we're celebrating last week's Women's Day. Local Montreal group Women of Diverse Origins organized the March 8th demo, where approximately 500 people took to the streets. Today, we're bringing you some of the highlights.
Happy International Women's Day. That I'm here from Missing Justice, which is short for Justice for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. And it's a campaign that it's a solidarity group that runs out of the 2110 Center for Gender Advocacy. It's been around since about 2009. And we're a group of people that organize events a lot around popular education, doing teach-ins to people in classes, considering the terrible state of the educational system when it comes to anything along the lines of Native history. We organized two annual marches, and our main goal throughout these last few years has really been to back up and stand behind and support the many demands already being made for decades and decades by Native women, their families, Native organizations, who have for a long, long time, much longer than I or many of you have been around, have been trying to draw attention to this insanely alarming issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada. Every week I hear about another case somewhere in the country, and I think that anyone at all, no matter what their gender or skin color or background, should be very, very, very concerned when one sector of the population, in this case a sector of the population that lives in Canada, is so disproportionately targeted for dying violently, for disappearing without a trace, and for most of these cases are very much unresolved. So we aside from organizing events where women can come and tell their stories, we try and communicate to people how our government, how our corporate media, how the police, how the court systems are all kind of in many ways complicit, different levels of complicit in this issue, from police force racism, which can look like many different things, from delaying investigations to perpetuating negative stereotypes about Native women and their communities, to any other number of excuses for not searching for a missing Native woman or girl, to corporate media who either don't cover cases at all without families badgering them, to at best covering the issue but failing to insert any systemic analysis whatsoever or engage our government on their own role in the situation, to court systems who disproportionately place Native women themselves behind bars, and perpetrators, when they are very, very rarely, do come into court systems getting minimal sentences. So I'm here to basically just call attention to this issue, especially in a context when a couple of weeks ago there was a big media storm about the RCMP in BC having allegations of sexually assaulting Native women there. And for years I've been hearing about sexual violence by police themselves, and so it was kind of new to see it blow up in the media in this way. I just hope that in a context where the Canadian government keeps saying that they prioritize the issue, keeps saying that it's important to them and they're going to take measures to make Native women safer, but turn around and do the opposite, that things like this actually showing up in media can help to open people's eyes. Another thing I'd like to focus on myself in the coming year is curriculum change, and actually at a high school level, sort of changing the types of history that students learn so that people can sort of understand more the roots of the issue and stop placing blame on Native communities and on Native women.
La coordinatrice du mouvement autonome et solidaire des sans-emploi, Marie-Hélène.
En fait, moi, c'est ça. Ce soir, on m'a invitée pour venir vous parler un petit peu de l'impact de la réforme sur les femmes. Bon, ce qu'il faut savoir, c'est que déjà, avant même la réforme, la loi sur l'assurance-emploi était faite en faisant en sorte que les femmes avaient moins accès à de l'assurance-emploi lorsqu'elles perdaient leur emploi. Mais avec la réforme, on va venir aggraver cette tendance-là, cette difficulté d'accès envers les femmes, des femmes envers le régime d'assurance-emploi. En fait, ce que la réforme fait, c'est qu'elle vient, entre autres, c'est qu'elle vient créer trois catégories de prestataires. En fonction des catégories, il y a différents droits qui vont être associés. Puis pour, dans le fond, la façon d'établir les catégories, c'est en fonction de la relation du travailleur avec le régime. Donc, plus une personne va avoir cotisé à l'assurance-emploi et moins elle va avoir eu recours à du chômage, plus cette personne-là va être dans une catégorie favorable. Et cette catégorie-là va lui permettre de rechercher un emploi qui est un meilleur emploi qu'une personne qui aurait eu plus souvent accès, qui aurait eu plus souvent des épisodes de chômage ou qui aurait moins cotisé au régime. Donc, en fait, si on regarde, la catégorie la meilleure catégorie, c'est les travailleurs de longue date. Dans le fond, ce qu'on constate, c'est que beaucoup de femmes ne pourront pas être dans cette catégorie-là. Parce que, en fait, pour être dans cette catégorie-là, il faut avoir, entre autres, cotisé au régime 7 des 10 dernières années. Et il faut avoir cotisé 30 % du maximum de la rémunération assurable. En fait, si on y va sur le 7 des 10 dernières années, on sait que les femmes, souvent, ont tendance, il y a une tendance que les femmes se retrouvent à s'éloigner un petit peu du marché du travail pour des responsabilités familiales ou parce qu'elles ont des enfants. Donc, voilà. Fait qu'il y a beaucoup de femmes qui n'auront pas cotisé dans les 10 dernières années ces 7 années-là. Fait que déjà, ils ne correspondront pas à cette catégorie-là. Puis en plus, il faut avoir cotisé 30 % du maximum de la rémunération assurable. Ce que ça veut dire, c'est si on regarde la tendance, déjà là, le 2/3 des emplois à temps partiel sont occupés par des femmes. Ce que ça veut dire, c'est que les femmes, souvent c'est en dehors de leur propre volonté, travaillent moins d'heures que les hommes. Donc déjà là, si elles travaillent moins d'heures, elles cotisent moins au régime. Et en plus, on le sait, les femmes ont des salaires inférieurs à ceux des hommes. Donc, elles n'auront peut-être pas atteint le montant, le 30 % du maximum assurable. Fait que déjà là, ces femmes-là sont exclues de cette catégorie-là. Fait que tout de suite, elles vont être... beaucoup de femmes vont se retrouver dans la catégorie dite de prestataire occasionnel ou prestataire fréquent, ce qui implique, en fait, d'être obligée de se trouver un emploi allant jusqu'à 70 % du salaire qui était gagné auparavant. Puis n'importe quel emploi, indépendamment de ta formation, tes intérêts ou... c'est ça. Donc, ça va avoir vraiment un impact là, sur l'accès des femmes à l'assurance-emploi. Puis aussi, surtout, au lieu, dans le fond, on sait déjà qu'il y a un écart, il y a une égalité entre les salaires des hommes et les femmes. Avec cette réforme-là, on va venir aggraver encore plus cet écart-là parce qu'on va obliger les femmes, déjà qui ont un bas salaire, à accepter un emploi à 70 % du salaire qui était gagné avant.
We talked with Shyam Patel, a McGill University student who tells us why he chooses to actively identify as a feminist, as well as Molly Swain, a McGill University student of Métis origin who spoke about Native women's history and achievements throughout the years.
This week it's an important week because it's International Women's Week. For me, International Women's Day or week is almost every day because I think it's if you respect not just women but also men, and human beings in general, it should be a day in, day out sort of movement and not just a week movement. It's a good way of raising awareness for those who aren't really aware about the issues at hand. I think specifically with feminism, we have progressed. There's a lot of work to do. A lot of men who feel that identifying as a feminist is feminine, makes you queer or weak in some way. And I think for me, the reason why I'm a feminist or why I identify as a feminist is because of my background. So I started off first by calling myself a male feminist, which one day one of my professors pointed out is an issue, because that in itself also creates a problem, because you don't identify as a feminist, you're categorizing yourself as a male feminist. So I took that out and said, you know what, that's true. I'm a feminist, not a male feminist. And I think that's standing in line with sort of solidarity. But moreover, why it's close to my heart is because I have a younger sister, I have a mom, and my grandmother. And I think those are the three individuals in my life who are really inspirational. And they've each sort of taught me something. So I think women in my life have given me sort of guidance and advice that I really need, although it may not be direct. In an indirect form, because of them, I am who I am. I come from a family where women are expected to conform to some societal norms, like cooking, cleaning, and doing sort of those duties that are always associated with women. And she stands her ground. My mom is definitely someone I care about and who's pushed me forward. There's also expectations, especially for women from my culture, to get married at a younger age with someone you don't really know. And I think I would never want that to happen to my sister. And it also touches into like accessibility of education. If you get married at a young age, you most likely aren't going to finish university. Or if you do, you most likely are expected afterwards to like stay at home. So you're not actually completing your profession. So for my sister, I think I want her to have the same rights that I have. And I think that's why I'm a feminist. Like, I feel there isn't another alternative to feminism, because without it, things just wouldn't feel or be right. Because I can't wake up in the morning knowing that my counterparts, whether it be gender, sexual orientation, race, or anything, have some sort of disadvantage in terms of moving forward and being progressive. And as long as that isn't solved in some way, shape, or form, or being discussed, I think I have some sort of role to play, either significant or not. Everything matters. So I think that's why I'm a feminist. And I feel men can really be involved in the conversation. It's difficult in the sense that it's stronger to say I'm a woman and I'm a feminist, because only you can experience being a woman. I think if you identify as a male, it's easy to say you're a feminist, but you should understand also that you're not a woman, and that the privileges that you have are different, and the challenges that you face are also very significantly different. So for me, that's something I try to understand first, but I identify as a feminist not just in standing in solidarity, but also recognizing that without women, I wouldn't be the person who I am today. So I think a lot more men have to think that way. There's always this connotation where that if you're a feminist as a guy, or as a male rather, I should be specific, that you're doing something wrong. And I think there are sort of traits that are also associated in society, like being weak, not being strong enough, or manly. And I think it should be the reverse. I feel like if you're a respectable, competent individual, you should be a feminist, because that is progressive in its nature. And it takes a lot of courage to say that as a guy, that you are a feminist. So I think, for me, I see it in the reverse way, but I do not think all men think of that way. And I think men being involved also helps with a lot of issues, like violence against women. That is something that a lot of men perpetuate. And there are sort of movements on how men can stop rape. And I know, like, I hear in my classroom sometimes people making rape jokes. I think that is probably my strongest pet peeve, because it's easy to say, you know, I don't like saying this, but I'm saying it for the sake of using an example. I was just raped by my exam. I think people often don't understand what that means. You know, when you say rape, that's a very sensitive topic, but it's also a physical action that isn't based on consent. So when you say that even about an exam, I think it's inappropriate. So I feel men can really engage in this conversation through that, by not using sort of statements like that, by being more respectful, and also not, you know, thinking that feminism is the wrong way of moving forward. Because a lot of men do think that, you know, women have equal rights, which is very easy to say, but you have to look at a lot of analyses and processes that are inherent in our society. Women still are not being paid at many places at the same level. We also saw that with Minaka, for example. I think we talked about Minaka through a labor perspective, but not as much as an issue of gender, because 85% of Minaka workers are women, and that's a big issue on campus, and I'm not sure why it wasn't as raised. And can stand in solidarity and support by not only voicing their opinions, but also like developing plans that help women and men. Because I feel working together is the best way to move forward, but you also have to be very principled in the way you interact with individuals on a day-to-day basis. What I do often is tell myself, not just with issues of feminism, but also anything, when I feel snarky, I just try to put myself in the other person's shoe and try to understand it better. And I think that's what men need to do more with feminism. And I'm hoping that, luckily, these conversations will begin more. So I'm happy that we're doing a lot of these workshops, or even if they're very small, it's starting something. And I think next year, moving forward, what we need to do more is sort of really promote and try to get out there and involve men in the conversation. I think why there's such a stigma for feminism and people who support feminism is because the word is very fully loaded. And I think it's an ism. And I think there are an issue with all isms in some shape or form. People are intimidated by it or feel that it's, especially if you're not an activist, they find it problematic. So I think it's always going to be an issue. The best thing to do is to provide information. As long as we engage in dialogue and exchange information, that's what's needed. It's going to take a lot of work, because I know some people think feminism has been reached and the glass ceiling has been tapped.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I still think we see it. For example, with Hillary Clinton, I think she's someone I admire. Politically, we may disagree on some little issues, but I think something people forget is that her campaign, quite a few people focused on her gender than they did on her politics, more than any other candidate. And the media's perception and the way they treated her is also very influential, in the sense that, oh, what is she wearing today? She's wearing a pantsuit.
Yeah.
The media also plays a huge role.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell how underrepresented women's issues are, because the media does not have much coverage on feminism. Like, some people who identify as feminists think that men cannot be feminist. I think that's fair. It's extremely fair, in the sense that, again, you know, if you want to identify something, you can never fully do so if you're not physically and emotionally capable of doing so. When you say I'm a feminist, it means you're respecting the principles and the ideologies, which is very important.
What I'm going to talk about, at least for a little while, is all based kind of around and under, through and with the Indian Act. So the Indian Act. So it's an 1875 document that has been amended many, many times since 1876. And it gives the Canadian government power to regulate Indian affairs, land, and registration. So essentially what that means is the Indian Act and the Canadian government decides who is a First Nations, Métis, or Inuit, as well as it also decides certain legal rights which cannot be denied in any court or any body in Canada, supposedly. As you will see, that's not always the case. There was a legal amendment in 1951, and that amendment is actually the most recent to enfranchise Indian women. And now enfranchisement in this case means to strip them of their status. And the way that it did that was by, if you were a Native woman, sorry, I'm using Indian and Native kind of interchangeably, I'm not a huge fan of the term Indian, but basically if you were a Native woman and you married a non-Native man, you would lose your status. Conversely, if you were a non-Native woman who married a Native man, you would gain status. And so we can see that that is a big issue. So legal wrangling on this issue of enfranchisement of Indian women had actually been going on for almost a century, with the first provisions about it being introduced in 1869, which was before the actual Indian Act had even taken place. So this idea that the Canadian government, or the pre-Canada government even, had a right to decide who and who was not Native and to decide women's identities had been going on for a very, very long time. So this very first provision read, provided always that any Indian woman marrying any other than an Indian shall cease to be an Indian within the meaning of this act, nor shall the children issued of any such marriage be considered as Indians within the meaning of this act, provided also that any Indian woman marrying an Indian of another tribe, band, or body shall cease to be a member of the tribe, band, or body to which she formerly belonged, and become a member of the tribe, band, or body of which her husband is a member, and the children issue of this marriage shall belong to the father's tribe only. So, for example, if you were a Cree and you married into the Lakota tribe, you would no longer be a Cree. Basically, what the Indian Act does and has done since the very beginning is treat Native folks as though they are children. The Canadian government has been trying to place itself as kind of this all-seeing, all-knowing parent who knows what's best for Aboriginal folks. So when we look at these provisions and how it surrounds the enfranchisement of Native women, we clearly see that this is a serious issue when it comes to gender equity. A woman would basically be subsumed under her husband's identity and lose her own identity. So how was this permitted? So according to the Supreme Court of Canada, case of the 1970s, when this finally started coming to light in the mainstream, the 1951 amendment to Section 12.1b, which is kind of the amendment that is pertaining to this, where a woman would lose her status, the Section 12.1b was not discriminatory because at the same time as it stripped Indian women and their children of their status, it granted non-Indian women and their children status upon marrying Indian men. And so this apparently was a legally acceptable, I guess, thing that happened. So under Section 12.1b, women who married non-status men no longer had the right to live on the reserve, educate their children in reserve schools, vote in band or council elections, share in band monies, own or inherit property on the reserve, and furthermore, none of their children would ever qualify for legal status under the Indian Act. In a lot of ways, this was a form of cultural genocide. Cultural genocide is recognized as genocide under the UN Convention of Genocide of 1945, I believe. Cultural genocide means very deliberate form of assimilation. So by denying Indian women and their children's status and denying them the right to live on the reserve, etc., basically it meant that the children could not be educated in the traditions, could not learn a lot of times their own language, and were not allowed in a lot of ways to associate with their families, because a lot of Native women especially came from lower economic backgrounds and were not able to get onto the reserve or get their family off the reserve to visit. The other thing that's really interesting was in the early years, just after contact, European explorers and settlers were like completely shocked at the power and authority that Native women had in their communities. It's actually hilarious if you go back and read original like Jesuit journals and diaries and that kind of thing, how really, really appalled they are at how kind of like forthright and confident and powerful these women are. And it's also hilarious because these missionaries love to describe Native women in similar ways to how like feminists are described today. So like mannish, hairy, really large, loud, intimidating, like it's awesome. But in fact, women had always been the cultural backbones of their communities. They were traditionally keepers of the traditions as well as mothers. And motherhood in most Native communities, or at least a lot of Native communities, carries a lot of significance. So it's also really important to note that women's roles of motherhood and nurturing had very, very different connotations from what we generally consider to be, I guess, like a Eurocentric tradition of what a mother is. Motherhood and basically this idea of like carrying on the traditions and carrying on the culture was granted like a lot of power and respect. So by removing women from their communities and denying them their identity, the Canadian government had found a great way to divide Indian communities and remove the strongest foundation from those communities and to quietly continue to kill the Indians, save the man, by denying any future generations their heritage. So, Section 12.1b of the Indian Act had some pretty devastating consequences for many women who were left destitute, without homes. So Native women started fighting back. Mary Two Acts Early was the first woman to regain her status in 1985, and she began her legal struggle after a friend had died because of the refusal of the band to provide her with services. So the band wouldn't heat her house, it wouldn't send running water to her house, the place was dilapidated, falling apart, this woman ended up dying. So Jeanette Corbière-Laval and Yvonne Bédard managed to take their cases to the Supreme Court of Canada, only to have them rejected in 1973 for the reasons discussed. From there, these women all knew one another, and they all kind of teamed up, and a woman named Sandra Lovelace was eventually kind of volunteered or was chosen to represent kind of, I guess, this overarching theme of disenfranchisement. And she was also, Sandra Lovelace, also the first Aboriginal woman appointed to Senate, which is pretty rad. So she took up the fight afterwards and was petitioned the UN Human Rights Commission for years and years. And in Lovelace versus Canada, she successfully had Section 12.1b removed in 1985. So from there, women started joining traditionally male organizations like the Native Council of Canada in order to solve their issues, but were often met with resistance from both Native men and non-Indians. And this resistance was actually sometimes violent. So Native men had concerns that like really eerily echo the concerns of pre-suffrage men or pre-suffrage non-Native men, especially in the States. So basically, if Indian women were allowed to keep their status and vote in banned elections, then Indian men would be outvoted and lose all their power. Besides joining the fight and working kind of within and with traditionally male organizations, Native women also started forming and working in their own organizations, such as the Quebec Native Women's Association and the feminist organizations like NAC, which is the National Action Committee for Women, who welcomed them and actually allowed them to maintain their autonomy, which is super, super important in a lot of ways, because a lot of what we see, particularly in the United States with feminist movements, is that marginalized groups of women, so lesbians, women of color, Native women, will come into these organizations and their concerns will be subsumed into the larger goal, which is often like a middle-class white woman's kind of fight. But luckily, NAC allowed these women's groups to keep their autonomy and basically provided solidarity and resources without overwhelming or co-opting the message. The Native Women's Walk took place in 1979, and it was from Oka, Quebec, to Ottawa. It took 5 days, and the result was that the Joe Clark government pledged to make changes to the Indian Act demanded by the participants of the walk. So this was in 1979, so one of those main changes was demanding that Section 12B of the Indian Act be revoked. But unfortunately for all the women involved, his government actually fell shortly afterwards to Trudeau. So it took 6 more years and a UN petition to change the law.
You're listening to Dragonroot Radio on CKUT 90.3, Tuesday morning after. I'd like to thank Montreal group Women of Diverse Origins for organizing last week's Women's Day March. And for those of you at McGill, the Sexual Assault Center of the McGill Student Society is up for renewal in the referendum. Be sure to support SACOMS as they run a lot of great initiatives and essential services. And tomorrow, Wednesday, March 13th, the Dragonroot Project is bringing the community a workshop on systemic discrimination of migrant workers. The workshop starts at 6 p.m. at the 2110 Center for Gender Advocacy. We've come to the end of today's edition of Dragonroot Radio, but be sure to tune in next Tuesday morning from 8:39 to hear more reports on gender issues.